for today,
Dolph told the two bloodied boys.
You're losing your touch if you were taken in by a pretty face, Darrigan.
What can I say? She was persuasive, but she's not your usual type, Hart said as he watched the boys leave. Though she does remind me a little of Lena. Too much of a hellcat to fall in line easily. So maybe she is your type after all. My mistake.
Don't,
Dolph growled.
Where'd you find her?
Hart pushed, ignoring the tension that had risen between them at his mention of Lena. He knew it was a low blow, one she'd have taken him to task for, but he would use whatever advantage he could, and he'd hold Dolph accountable for what he'd done to her.
You're not here because of her,
Dolph eyed him.
You think I don't know that Kelly's men have been breathing down your neck lately?
Hart went still.
Oh, come off it, Dolph said. I have eyes in every part of this city. I heard about the fire the other day, and I know that Razor Riley helped to set it.
Hart held up his hands.
You know what? I was wrong. Turns out I can't do this, he said,
taking a step backward, preparing to leave.
I'd say it was good to see you again, Dolph, but you don't deserve the effort it would take to lie.
He turned and let his feet take him toward the door, but he hadn't finished crossing the room when Dolph spoke.
You know I can protect you from Paul Kelly. Your mother, too. I would have done it years ago if you weren't so damn stubborn and proud.
Hart stopped where he was, but he hated Dolph that much more for knowing the one thing that would keep him listening.
I'm still not willing to pay the price for your help. I'm not taking your mark, he said.
He kept his eyes focused in front of him.
I haven't offered it,
Dolph said, his voice tight.
You did once.
He turned back to look at Dolph and let his old friend see that he wouldn't be swayed.
I came that day, you know. I saw what you did to that man, what your mark did to him.
It had taken him 2 years more to gather enough of Kelly's secrets to negotiate his exit from the gang, but he'd solved his own problems then. He'd do it again if he had to.
I didn't realize. Did Lena know?
Hart asked.
Did she have any idea what you were playing at?
Back then, Hart had left because he was afraid, but now he knew enough to understand that what Dolph's mark had done stank of ritual magic. Dolph's jaw went tight.
That's none of your... Lena would never have been okay with it. She didn't know how dangerous things were,
Dolph snapped,
or how precarious our position was.
He took a breath as though trying to calm himself.
Lena was too good for this world,
Dolph said softly.
You're Lena?
Hart laughed.
Maybe she was a saint. She must have been to put up with you, but she was also tough as nails and smarter than anyone.
I bet she was livid when she found out you were dabbling in ritual magic. I would have bought tickets to watch that fight. From the flush in Dolph's cheeks, Hart knew he was right.
She understood.
I bet she did, Hart mocked, shaking his head.
Do you really think I'm the first magus to try strengthening my power?
Dolph asked.
Of course not.
Stories of mages trying to make themselves stronger by using ceremonies or ritual objects were as old as magic itself. They were the source of legends about witches and shamans, magical creatures the Sundren feared. No, Dolph wasn't the first to try to claim more than he was born with, and he wouldn't be the last.
Weren't you the one who taught me the cost of what the Order was doing? The way they damaged magic itself each time they manipulated the elements and claimed power that wasn't theirs?
Dolph scowled at him.
You weren't around then. You don't know what it was like. I didn't know who I could trust or who I could depend on. So yes, I did what I had to do to protect mine. How else was I supposed to fight against the Order?
I don't know. Hart shook his head. Dolph couldn't even see how many lines he'd crossed to get what he wanted.
But you weren't supposed to become them.
I'm nothing like the Order, Dolph snapped.
No?
Hart pressed.
The Order thinks that what they're doing is right, that they're only protecting what's theirs, their land, their people, their country. That's how everyone else sees it, too. The whole city believes them, believes magus are something to be feared, and lets the Order have their way. Your mark could destroy a person, did destroy a person. How is that any different from what the Order does? How will you be any different if you get this book you're after?
The muscle in Dolph's jaw jumped, and his whole body radiated tension.
"Considering how cozy you've been getting with Jack Grew, I can't imagine you really care."
"You're right, I don't." The Order, the Bowery, the city itself, it was all the same to Hart. Each one was holding him down, holding him back. He'd throw them off one by one until he was free, or he'd die trying. Dolph glared at him.
"Did you come because you're finally willing to join us, or only to remind me of my failures?"
They'd finally come to it. He wasn't sure he could do it until the words were already out.
"You want my help?"
Hart told Dolph.
"I'm willing to give it in exchange for protection. I want Kelly off my back for good, and I want my mother safe. But you'll have to take my word for a guarantee. I won't be branded by you, not for anything."
It was a gamble. If Dolph rejected his offer, he'd have to deal with Kelly on his own. If Dolph demanded that Hart take his mark, he'd be as shackled to Dolph as he'd been to Paul Kelly, and Hart wouldn't, couldn't let that happen. A long minute passed, the two of them standing in stony silence, waiting to see who would break first.
"Fine,"
Dolph said. His hand was gripping his cane so tightly his knuckles were white.
"I'll take your word. But if you go back on it, I'll destroy the life you've built for yourself one piece at a time. I'll make sure the entire city knows what you truly are. If the Order doesn't finish you off, Viola will."
"Fine with me," Hart said. If everything went to plan, he wouldn't be in the city to care, and if things went as badly as they could go, he'd gladly take a quick death at Viola's hand over whatever Paul Kelly or the Order would dish out.
"I have to say I'm a little surprised you agreed."
"Things have changed," Dolph said. "We can't afford to wait for the Order's next move."
He told Hart about what had happened to Tilly, about how she'd had her magic stripped from her, how at that very moment she was fighting for her life.
"You think the Brink has moved?"
Hart asked, chilled by the idea.
"I don't know, but this latest attack makes me more sure than ever. We have to take the Order down. To do that, I need the book. To get the book, we need a way into Khafra Hall, as well as a way out that doesn't involve getting everyone killed."
Hart gave a hollow laugh.
"Is that all?"
"Probably not, but it's the minimum.
If you don't have Jack Grew on the hook already, you will. It's only a matter of time. I've heard about him. Brash, quick-tempered, and has something to prove. He's the perfect mark."
"That's the problem. Everyone's heard about him, and he knows it. He's skittish," Hart said.
"Unpredictable. His family knows it, and they watch him pretty closely. I'm not one of them. No matter how well I shine up, if they warn him off, he'll listen, because he has too much to lose with them right now."
He gave Dolph a knowing look. "Especially after that mess at the Metropolitan."
"So make him think he can't lose."
Dolph gave him an impatient glare.
"I've been trying, but it's not so easy. He wants me to find out what happened at the museum."
He paused, never blinking, as he sent the clear message that he knew Dolph had been behind the robbery.
"I'm assuming you don't want him to discover the truth. So give him something better."
"What are you proposing?"
"Use the girl,"
Dolph said.
"She can help you hook him. She's already established her cover, hasn't she?"
"The long-lost lover angle?" Hart said, realizing exactly how deep her game had been the day before. She'd penned him more ways than one.
"The daughter of one of your illustrious teachers. I bet she would have secrets Jack Grew would love to learn,"
Dolph said with a satisfied smile.
"Secrets that could make him a huge success in the Order. That's what he really wants."
He hated the fact that Dolph was right.
"I already told her I work alone," Hart said. "Not anymore. And not if you want my protection,"
Dolph told him.
"You won't take my mark, but you will agree to work with Esta. Otherwise, you're welcome to take your chances with Kelly and his boys. Your mother, too. I won't make this offer twice."
Hart's jaw was so tight his temple ached.
"It's not much of a choice when you put it like that."
Dolph shrugged.
"There's always a choice. The question is which one you're willing to live with."
"You or Kelly?" Hart said, his voice as threatening as his mood.
"Why do I feel like I'm only getting to pick my poison?"
"It's still a choice,"
Dolph drawled. Hart shook his head.
"You always were a bastard."
Takes one to know one.
There was a hint of amusement in Dolph's expression.
Fine. We'll do it your way. But when this is over, you don't bother me again. You don't contact me or try to find me. If we're all not already dead, you don't even know me. Period.
The amusement faded from Dolph's face.
Agreed. But if I get any hint of you going against me or mine, I won't hesitate to end you. My mark or no, I will strip you of everything you hold dear.
You should have gone on the stage, Hart said dryly. You've developed quite the flair for the dramatic. If that's all?
That's all.
Dolph nodded. Then he softened his voice.
It really is good to see you again.
I can't say the feeling is mutual, Hart said, but he couldn't stop his mouth from curving up.
Keep my mother out of Paul Kelly's grasp, and you won't have anything to worry about on my end. I'll get what you need.
Hart extended his hand to shake on the deal they'd made. Dolph shook his head.
I wasn't born yesterday, dear. I have a few things to take care of, but I'll be sending Esta to you in a couple of days.
What do you mean? Hart asked. His hand dropped to his side.
She'll be staying with you and keeping an eye on things while the two of you work together.
She can't stay with me, he shook his head. I don't want her there. Dolph laughed.
I won't call you on that lie, but you're going to have to take her.
You know it'll ruin her, Hart argued, unexpected anger curling in his stomach at the thought.
Her reputation won't recover. That won't matter if the Order kills us first.
Dolph pulled himself to his feet.
You worry about keeping your end of our agreement. She'll let me know of any unwanted developments.
Hart could only stand there, his frustration rising as he watched Dolph limp off in the same direction the two boys had gone, dismissing him without so much as a goodbye. The reek of the sour, coppery, dried blood wrapped around his throat, choking him. He wasn't sure if he'd managed to negotiate a good deal or simply tied a noose around his own neck.
That's it, he called out. You're going to send me the girl, and I'm supposed to figure out the rest? I take on all the risk, and you sit safe in your castle? I've already given you everything you need.
Dolph turned to look at him over his shoulder.
But...
Yeah, he snapped, his frustration mounting.
The girl's currently under my protection,
Dolph said softly.
So if you actually do ruin her, you'll answer to me.
Part 3 Ruined. The docks. The machine was in ruins. Metal fragments were lodged in the wood of the walls and in the chest of the old man. The hulking globe in the center looked like it had melted. Jack nudged the body with his toe.
Damn it. All of his work had been for nothing. Months of work, months of waiting, wasted.
Get this cleaned up,
he told the boy who'd brought him the news. He tossed him a coin.
Then put out word that I need a machinist. Now.
And the old man? The boy asked, eyeing the body warily.
Dump him in the river.
Jack didn't stay to make sure the work was done. The warehouse, even with all its square footage, felt claustrophobic, like the walls were pressing in on him, squeezing him until there wasn't a drop of blood left for him to give. He'd risked everything, gambled everything, and he had been so close. Damn it! He kicked over a barrel and sent a pair of rats skittering away. There was still something he was missing, some key to making the machine work. There had to be, because he wouldn't let himself believe that they were more powerful. Reason and logic would prevail. He would prevail. The machine should have been perfectly functional. The problem would have been easy enough to figure out if the High Princept would just let him consult the Ars Arcana. Certainly, the Order's most important artifact, their most sacred text, would have the answers he needed. But there were parts of Khafra Hall only the Inner Circle had access to, and the Mysterium with all its secrets was one of them. So unless something changed, he was on his own. Tugging at the collar of his shirt, Jack stomped back out to the carriage. When his father found out what had happened to the money in his trust fund, when his uncle and the rest of the Inner Circle found out, Jesus, they'd never let him in. Worse, he'd never be able to set foot in society again.
Damn it!
He needed more information. He needed the Order to trust him enough to let him into the Mysterium, because he knew the answer was there. Solving the Metropolitan robbery would go a long way toward getting into their good graces, but Hart Darrigan had been avoiding him the last few days. He was trying to be patient, trying to give the magician a chance to work on the problem, but at this rate the machine would never be done in time for the conclave. He needed to figure out what he was missing and fast, or he'd be ruined. But most of all, he needed a drink. Dreams from Waking. Bella Strega. Something had happened. It had come suddenly and absolutely, as a wave might overtake a small boat out to sea, leaving Viola struggling to stay afloat. For 3 days she'd watched her friend suffer, writhing and moaning despite the laudanum in the wine. For 3 days she had paced the floor in Tilly's room or sat on the edge of her narrow bed, holding her hand and whispering everything she'd wanted to say for so long. Night and day she'd stayed. Tilly couldn't hear her, but night and day Viola continued whispering, using her mother tongue, because the words felt right in that language. Her meaning felt somehow more suited for the soft, melodic rhythm of the country that had made her. But her words and prayers had not been enough. Neither had her power. She was an assassin, but only because that was what the world had made her into. Because her brother had needed a black hand of death to smite his enemies, and his life was the only one her family valued. His success was all that had mattered to them. She might have been made an assassin, but her affinity had never been intended for death. And nothing they did, nothing anyone could do, had changed that. But it wasn't enough. She wasn't enough. Even now she could sense Tilly's blood, the beating of her fragile heart, the energy that was the very signal of life within a body. Even now she pushed everything she was, every ounce of power she had, into her friend. She had been doing it for days, but no matter what she did, the broken part wouldn't heal. Because Viola could only command flesh. And what was broken in Tilly was something more. Around dawn, something had changed. The wave had come over them. Cold as the lonely sea she had once crossed, and the fight had gone out of her friend. That spark of energy that signaled a life began to waver. And for the first time since Viola had seen Tilly writhing in John Yu's arms, she truly worried that Tilly might not pull through. Since then, Tilly's skin had gone even more ashen, and now she lay still, her chest rising and falling in uneven, ragged breaths that rattled in her throat. Viola had heard that sound before, but now she could not, would not, allow herself to believe its message. She barely noticed when Esta went to find Dolph or when he arrived. Even when the room began to fill with the people from his crew who had loved Tilly, who had depended on her calm, steady presence in the Strega's kitchen, Viola was scarcely aware of them. She, whose every day was filled with the rushing thrum of rivers of blood, the beating drumbeats of a world filled with hearts. The crowd in the room might as well have been made of stone that morning for all she noticed them, as she fought against the truth lying in Tilly's bed, as she willfully ignored the way her friend's hands had turned cool, the way her fingertips and nails had lost all color. Dolph stepped forward from his vigil at the foot of the bed.
You know what needs to be done, Vi. You know it's time to let her go.
Viola shook her head, pressing her lips together.
She'll be better tomorrow. I know she will.
Dolph rested his hand on Viola's shoulder.
I understand,
he said softly.
I know exactly what it's like to watch someone you care for slide away from you, to watch your own heart cease to beat.
Viola swallowed down the hard stone she felt in her throat and turned to him.
She is not dying. Her magic's gone,
Dolph told her.
It has been days. Now she's going to. It's time we let her. It's time you let her.
She will not die,
Viola repeated, her voice barely a whisper.
She will fight. She will be better. I just need to give her more time.
You know that's not true,
Dolph said gently.
Yes, she did fight. You've helped her, and she fought hard. But what's happened is too much. It would have been too much for any of us. Think of what it would be like. What it would mean to lose your power. Can you imagine not being able to reach a part of yourself? To feel it stripped away?
His voice broke and he paused for a moment to compose himself. To live without it? Viola grimaced.
No,
she whispered. All at once she realized what he must have felt watching Lena die. No wonder he had seemed so changed after.
Tilly's fought hard enough. Allow her the rest she's earned.
Anger spiked through her, drowning the pain with a sense of righteous fury. She would not be commanded. She would not be the instrument of death. Not this time. She would use her affinity to keep Tilly's heart beating, and in doing so atone for all those other hearts she'd stopped, and no one would stop her. Not Dolph Saunders, not even with the threat of his mark. Dolph staggered a bit, his lean face twisting with pain as she let her power fill the room, as she found all the parts of him that made him a living man and started to pull them apart one by one. Slowly. So he could feel what she felt. She was so focused she didn't notice the way others rustled in fear, backed away.
"You know I'm right,"
Dolph gasped, gripping his cane as he tried to stay upright.
"Do this last thing for her."
Viola shook her head, her vision blurry with tears as her power crackled through the room.
"Free her,"
Dolph said, barely able to stand. The veins in his cheeks had turned dark, like tiny rivers floating to the surface of his skin.
"Kill me if you must, but let her go," he rasped.
Yes, she would kill him for even suggesting it. She'd killed before and for lesser reasons. But despite what people believed, she did not often kill like this. Years ago, she had learned to throw knives, to carve out a life with the sharp tip of a blade, because she knew her God damned her for using her gift to take lives, as her brother wanted, rather than to save them as she could. But she would use everything she was now. She would risk the fires of hell and everything that came with them for Tilly, for herself. Dolph staggered to his knees as she pushed her affinity toward him, felt the pulse, the light, and the broken pieces that even she couldn't heal. She realized then what he'd been carrying since that night they lost Lena, the secret he'd been hiding from them all. The fight went out of her. She released her affinity, let go of her hold on Dolph, and crumpled against Tilly's barely moving chest. Unable to stop the sob that tore from her throat, she stayed there, emptying herself of pain and grief, for who knew how long. Until she had nothing left, until she finally felt the warm, steady hand on her shoulder. She shrugged Dolph off and wiped the wetness from her cheeks.
"It's time," Dolph said. "Allow her to go in peace."
Viola turned to the crowded room, her eyes burning from the tears she'd shed. Who were these people? Not the family she'd been raised by, when blood was supposed to be thicker than anything. No, that family had turned from her. They'd wanted her to be what she could never be, and she had chosen again. She saw now in that motley group that she had chosen well, and so had Tilly.
"She wouldn't want them here for this," she told Dolph. "She wouldn't want them to see,
because it would be hard for them to watch. And Tilly would have hated their suffering, and because Viola somehow knew that Tilly wouldn't want them to understand what she could actually do." Tilly had seen through the mask she wore, had never believed her to be the cold-hearted assassin the rest saw. One person, knowing her truth, had been enough. It had to be because Viola's role was her shield. It allowed her to survive in a world that would rather see her dead. Tilly had understood that as well, and she had given Viola friendship, even when she could not give more. Dolph nodded, and one by one the silent crowd in the room began to depart. A few were brave enough to come forward and touch Viola gently on the back or the shoulder before they went. Then the new girl, Esta, came forward to take her turn as well. Esta touched her shoulder gently, like a bird landing on a branch. "I think she must have known how you felt for her," she whispered. Viola shook her head, wondering, as she had before, how this strange girl could see her so clearly.
"She would have despised me," Viola whispered.
"I don't think she would have. Tilly understood people." Esta gave her shoulder a gentle squeeze.
She loved you. Anyone could see that, even if it wasn't in the way you hoped.
Viola looked up, wanting to believe those words, and found Esther's eyes glassy with tears, but free from lies. Free, too, from the judgment she expected there.
I still don't know that I like you, she said. But Tilly did, and you're right. She did understand people. Better than I ever could. You'll stay?
Yes, she whispered to Viola. Of course.
Viola's throat was too tight to do more than nod her thanks. And then she turned her attention back to Tilly. She was afraid to look away. Afraid that the moment she blinked or stopped watching, she'd miss Tilly's last breath. Or that she would cause it. A suffocating silence blanketed the room, broken only by Tilly's rasping, uneven breath.
Viola, Dolph whispered gently. It's time.
Viola ignored him and took Tilly's hand in hers, rubbing her thumb over the pallid skin as her whole body trembled with the effort not to let her grief spill out and drown her. She lifted the limp hand to her cheek, closing her eyes and imagining for a moment that she was strong enough to save her friend, that this was all a horrible dream. But Viola knew dreams from waking. She knew the thick scent in the air and the rasping sound in Tilly's throat, and she'd never looked away from death before. She wouldn't look away now. Viola opened her eyes and took a long, deep breath as she placed Tilly's hand gently across the girl's own stomach. Then she whispered one last thing into her ear. Tilly blinked, turning her eyes ever so slightly to look up at Viola. For a moment her gaze was focused, as though she had come back to herself long enough to see who it was who stood above her, just long enough to say goodbye. Tears blurring her vision, Viola pulled her hand away, and with it, she pulled away her affinity, that fragile thread holding Tilly to this world. Life and death. Two sides to the same coin. Her family saw her as a killer, and so she had become one. Everyone else believed her to be a killer, because they forgot that death is simply the other side of life. But Viola never forgot. She couldn't. She'd tried to save her friend, and she'd failed. Tilly's chest heaved in a final, ragged breath, and then her body sank motionless back to the bed, her empty green eyes staring sightlessly above.
The Tree of Knowledge. Esther felt the room go cold, the magic draining from the space like air sucked from a vacuum. Viola reached over, her always steady hands shaking, and gently traced her fingertips over Tilly's face, closing the girl's eyes. Then she stared, mute and tearless, at the girl's still body. As Esther watched, she remembered suddenly what Logan had looked like, pale and unconscious in the narrow bed after the mess at Schwab's mansion. How was it possible that she hadn't thought about him for days now? Had life in this city been so all-consuming that she'd lost sight of why she was there? Then she thought of the clipping, still tucked safely against her skin. If the heist didn't happen, if she changed too much just by being here, what would happen to all the people she'd left behind?
Come, Dolph whispered, nodding toward the door. We'll give her the space she needs to grieve.
In the hall, he gave a silent jerk of his head to indicate that she should follow him. When they reached his rooms a floor below, he opened the door and ushered her through it. He gestured for her to take a seat in one of the chairs near the bookcases, and then he poured himself a drink. Esther was almost grateful to see that he seemed as shaken as she felt with what they'd witnessed. After downing the first glass of whiskey, Dolph poured himself another and then sat in the armchair across from her. He didn't speak at first. Instead, he swirled the liquid in the chipped cup he held in his broad, calloused hands before taking another long swallow. Finally, he looked up at her.
"Thank you for staying," he said,
his voice no more than a whisper. His jaw was tight, and in his eyes she could see the pain of losing Tilly, and if she wasn't mistaken, maybe the pain of something more.
It was nothing, she told him.
still unsteady from the rush of Viola's magic.
No, that's not exactly true.
His eyes were shadowed with the evidence of sleepless nights and worry.
Most aren't willing to bear witness to pain that can't be remedied. Most find it easier to simply turn away. On behalf of Viola and Tilly, I thank you for not doing that.
They sat there for a long while, an impromptu wake. Dolph took a drink every so often from his glass of whiskey while Esta waited for him to speak or to dismiss her so she could escape the heavy silence. He set his drink aside.
Hart Derrigan visited me yesterday. We've come to an understanding. I have you to thank for that.
Good, Esta said. I'm glad I could help.
I'm sending you to him.
What? She sat up straighter.
You'll need to pack your things.
Wait. You gave me to him? She asked, incredulous.
Of course not, Dolph said. I want a pair of eyes I trust on Derrigan at all times. What you did at the museum for John Yu and the rest of the crew, what you did today for Viola, you're one of us now. I'm trusting you can keep him on task.
Esta felt the instinctive need to argue. She didn't want to leave the Strega, didn't want to stay with Hart Derrigan. But she stopped herself. This was what she'd been hoping for all along, wasn't it? Dolph was handing her the perfect situation, a chance to get close to the magician, a chance to stop him before he ruined all their futures. She wouldn't waste it. What do you need from him?
Derrigan hasn't always been the polished magician he is now. Once he wasn't any different from any of the boys in the Bowery, but he's managed to carve out a new life for himself, and that new life comes with some very powerful friends.
He knows people in the Order? Dolph nodded.
Specifically, he's become friends with a fellow named Jack Grew, who happens to be J.P. Morgan's nephew. I don't need to explain to you how important a contact like that is. Not with what's happened to Tilly. I need information, and Derrigan is our best chance to get it. His connections are our best opportunity to get a crew into Khafra Hall.
She feigned surprise. You're not planning to rob them? Dolph nodded. That's a bigger risk than the Metropolitan, she said, pretending to be more concerned than she actually was.
It is. But if we do it right, the rewards are bigger, too. I want to end their reign over this city, over our kind.
Dolph leaned over to take a book from the shelf.
I want to make this land safe for magic.
He opened the volume. A ledger or journal of some sort. Its pages were filled with the same strong, even hand. He took a small envelope from between the pages and pulled out a worn scrap of fabric, which he handed to Esta. She looked closely at the faded and smeared letters.
That's blood. Dolph nodded. Someone died getting that message to me. A woman named Lena Rahal. A woman I trusted with my life.
What does it say? She frowned, playing dumb to lead him on. She didn't need him to know that she knew Latin as well as any of her other languages. Something about a book?
Have you ever heard of the Ars Arcana?
Esta shook her head, keeping her eyes on the bloodied words so the lie wouldn't show. Dolph flipped through the pages of the journal and, finding the place he wanted, held it out to her. On the page was an image that she recognized easily enough from her many lessons with Professor Lachlan. The Tree of Knowledge. This image was different from others she'd seen, though. Usually the tree's wide branches held symbols representing the ancient mysteries, alchemical notations that were attempts to explain the inner workings of heaven and earth. In this version, though, the tree was a flame, and the source of those flames was a book, like the bush Moses found. Like the fish in the center of the philosopher's hand, the book wasn't being destroyed by the fire.
There are stories passed down through time of a book that holds the secrets of the old magic. The Ars Arcana, or the Book of Mysteries. Some believe it contains the very beginnings of magic. Others believe its pages hold the history of mages. But legend has it that whoever possesses the book also can wield the power it contains. Of course, like the Golden Fleece or the Philosopher's Stone, the book is supposed to be nothing more than a story, a myth, Dolph told her. But I believe the Ars Arcana is real, and I believe the Ortus Aurea has it.
Because of this? she asked, holding up the scrap.
In part. But the more I've looked into it, the more sure I've become. That image isn't a simple picture. It's a complex arrangement of symbols, the book, a flame, the moon and stars circling. It should look familiar to you.
He gestured toward the painting hanging over his shelves, the one she'd helped to steal.
Newton is holding the same book, with the same symbols on its pages, she realized, looking between the two.
The circular symbol there is called the Sigil of Ameth, the Seal of Truth. The Order believes an initiated magician could use it to unlock power over all creatures below the heavens, and some above as well. The Ars Arcana is supposed to contain the one true sigil. I don't think it's any coincidence that J.P. Morgan, one of the highest-ranking members of the Order, owned that painting. I think Morgan couldn't help himself from bragging about his knowledge. The Order has the Ars Arcana. I know it.
You want to steal the book, she said, letting her excitement show.
We could use the knowledge it contains to destroy the Brink. Without the Brink and the book, the Order would be finished. More than that, I believe we could let magic, old magic, true magic, grow free again. Libero Libro, the book will free us.
Does Hart know all of this?
He knows what I'm after, Dolph admitted. And he knows the book could bring down the Brink.
Which is why he took it, Esta realized. He wanted it for himself. But then, why had he disappeared? Why had the book disappeared? It didn't make any sense. There had to be something more to what happened, and she would have to be smart and more patient than she'd ever been to figure it out, or risk disrupting the future even more.
Why are you telling me all of this now? Esta asked.
Because I need you to understand the importance of what we are undertaking. It will be difficult to do what I'm planning. Khafra Hall is a fortress. Without someone on the inside, the job will be impossible. Jack Grew's our way in, and Hart Darrigan is our way to him. So you'll go to Darrigan, and you'll make sure he gets Jack on the hook.
Before she could ask anything else, they were interrupted by a sharp knock at the door.
Come,
Dolph said, his eyes never leaving Esta's. Nibs opened the door.
There's news.
Well, get in here and tell me about it, Dolph barked.
With a nod, he stepped into the room and closed the door softly behind him.
Whatever happened to the deadline?
Nibs said.
It's done. Gone.
Dolph's brows drew together.
What do you mean, gone?
The crew you had patrolling over on Fulton said that it just disappeared. One minute it was there, and the next there was a flare of energy, and then they couldn't sense it anymore.
When was this?
A couple hours ago, Nibs said. I went down to check for myself before I came to you. I wanted to make sure, but it's gone, all right.
That was right about when Tilly got worse, Esta realized.
It was,
Dolph said, his expression stony. He finished his drink before he spoke again.
Gather your things and get yourself to Darrigan's. I want Gru on the hook, and I want it to happen before anyone else has to die.
Even kittens have claws. Hart's apartment.
Knowing how Dolph Saunders worked, Hart had half expected the girl to be waiting for him when he got back to the theater.
Actually, he'd planned on it. He'd spent the long walk back from the Devil's Own thinking of all the things he wanted to say to her. The rules he'd established to put her in her place and keep her there. When she didn't appear, he couldn't help feeling almost disappointed. And when she still hadn't made an appearance by the end of the night's second show, he could only wonder what Dolph was up to and whether he'd keep the bargain they'd made. Even prepared as he was, the last thing he expected to find when he let himself into his apartment late the next night was the girl, curled up like an overgrown kitten on the narrow couch in his front parlor. She was fast asleep, her head resting on her arm and her breathing soft and even. At first, he simply stood there staring. In sleep, her features looked different. Softer, somehow. Not that he was fooled into thinking she was harmless. Even kittens had claws, after all. And he'd had enough experience with this one to know hers were sharper than most. He wondered how long she'd been there. She looked uncomfortable, with her neck tipped to the side at such an awkward angle.
Her dress was a shade of blue that reminded him of the spring sky, but the hem was marred with the grime of the winter streets. He cringed at the sight of her damp boots up on the clean chintz upholstery. They would leave a mark if she stayed that way. With a sigh, he went over to the sofa.
"Esther," he whispered. "Come on, wake up."
She didn't seem to hear him, so he reached down to shake her arm gently.
"I said wake."
The next thing he knew, he was flat on his back on the carpet, staring up at the ceiling. He had no idea how she'd managed to move so quickly out of a dead sleep, but it had taken less than a second for her to sweep his legs out from under him with her ankle and twist his arms around to pin him to the floor. Her eyes were wide and furious, but they weren't really lucid until she blinked away the sleepiness in them and saw him beneath her.
"Oh,"
she said, confusion flashing across her otherwise intense expression.
"Off?"
He choked, barely able to breathe.
"Sorry,"
she murmured, her voice still rough and drowsy as she shifted off him.
"But you shouldn't grab me like that,"
she said sourly, as though her nearly breaking his neck had somehow been his fault.
"You shouldn't break into people's homes if you don't want to be grabbed."
He lifted himself to his feet and went to turn on another light.
"And I didn't grab you. I was trying to wake you. Your boots are ruining the furniture."
She blinked, her face wrinkling in confusion as she looked at her feet.
"They're clean,"
she argued, but she reached down and began unbuttoning them anyway. When she pulled off both boots, she left them in a heap on the floor and didn't bother to cover her slender ankles.
"How did you even get in here?"
he demanded, trying to gather his wits. There was something he was supposed to be telling her right now, something he was supposed to say.
"I was expecting you at the theater yesterday, not in my very locked, very secure apartment, not in the middle of the night."
"Not so very secure," she argued. "And it's barely past midnight."
"I didn't mean to fall asleep,"
she said, fighting off a soft yawn. Her hair was a mess, half tumbled down from sleep, but Hart focused on what was important. If he could just remember what that was. She gave in to the yawn. All the action did was call attention to her mouth, which made him remember other things that weren't exactly helpful at the moment. He'd made a mistake. A tactical error. This was never going to work if he couldn't focus long enough to take control.
"So am I going to be taking the couch, or are you going to be a gentleman and give me your bed?"
she asked, batting her eyes innocently.
"The only way you're getting into my bed is if I'm in there with you,"
he told her.
"Not likely,"
she drawled.
"Then I guess you're taking the couch,"
he told her.
"Best you learn now. I'm no gentleman."
"Figured as much," she said, pulling herself up and tossing him a pillow as she walked toward the back of the apartment.
"Where are you going?"
he asked.
"I need to use the facilities," she told him.
But she walked right past the open bathroom and into his bedroom, and before what she was doing completely registered, she'd shut his bedroom door and clicked the latch in place, leaving him holding the pillow. It took a second for him to process what had just happened, but once he did, he stormed across the apartment and pounded on the door.
"Open this door, Esther."
"No, thanks," she called from within.
"I'm good here." "I mean it. I'll bust it down if I have to."
There was a rustling sound from within that he refused to think about too closely. It couldn't be the sound of petticoats falling to the floor or her gown being unlaced. He would not allow himself to imagine her disrobing on the other side of the door. And even if she were, he would not let himself care.
"Feel free, it's your apartment," she said.
And he could practically hear the shrug in her voice. He ran his hands through his hair in exasperation.
"What are you doing in there?"
"What do you think I'm doing?" she called. He had a sudden vision of what she would look like in his bed, her dark hair spilled out across his pillows. But he locked that image down and threw away the key.
"I think you're trying to take my bed,"
he said, inwardly groaning at his bad luck.
"I don't think I'm trying at this point."
Her voice came from closer to the door now. His bed was going to smell like her if she slept there, and then he'd never be able to sleep soundly again. He pounded again and then eyed the door. He could probably break it down.
I want my bed, Esta.
The door cracked open and her face appeared. Her shoulders were bare except for the lacy straps of her chemise, and she'd taken her hair down so it fell around her shoulders in loose waves. Think of this as me helping you better yourself, she said as she tossed a small object at him. He grabbed for it out of instinct, giving her the time she needed to slam the door in his face and click the lock in place once more.
Better myself,
he looked down at the object he was holding. The pocket watch he'd lost at the Metropolitan Exhibition.
What's that supposed to mean?
Just what I said, Darrigan, she called through the closed door. By the time I'm through with you, you'll be a real live gentleman. The next morning when he woke, his neck was stiff from sleeping on the couch. He pulled himself up and ran a hand over his face, trying to rub away his grogginess and to will away the dreams of dark, silken hair and lacy chemises that left him feeling restless and unhinged. He was still in his clothes, since Esta had locked him out of his own room. But now, across the apartment, the door to his bedroom stood open. Approaching the door warily, he saw that his bed was rumpled and unmade. The blankets were thrown back, and in the center of the bed, the mattress sagged where someone had slept. But the girl wasn't there. She wasn't in his tiny closet of a kitchen, either. As he pulled on a fresh shirt, he had the brief, impossible hope that maybe the night before had all been part of the same awful dream. Then he heard the off-key singing coming from his bathroom. He knocked on the bathroom door.
Esta?
The singing suddenly went silent.
You didn't tell me you had a bathtub, she called. I didn't invite you to use it, either, he said.
Trying not to think of her soaking in the white porcelain tub, it didn't matter if it was his sanctuary, the mark of how different this life was from his old one. He didn't need the image of her tawny limbs, or any other part of her, naked in the warm water, in his warm water. He heard the sounds of sloshing, and a moment later the door opened. Esta was standing with one of his large towels wrapped around her. Her shoulders were bare again, and wisps of hair that had fallen from where she'd piled it on her head were stuck to her damp skin. Water was still dripping down her neck and her legs, leaving puddles on his tiled floor. For a moment, he couldn't think, much less speak.
You have a bathtub, she said again, and she made the word sound like something miraculous.
Her face was scrubbed clean, pink from the heat of the water, and she was smiling at him as though he'd just saved her life.
I'm never leaving.
Then she shut the door in his face again, his hands clenched into fists at his sides, and for a moment he had to focus on breathing. He had to remind himself that this would be worth it in the end. It would all be worth it when he walked out of the city a free man and left all of this behind him. He turned without a word, grabbed an orange from the bowl on his kitchen counter, threw on his hat and coat from the stand by the door, and left, slamming the door behind him. He'd go to the theater. People there might eat knives, dance with bears, and shimmy across the stage half-naked. But at least they didn't make him feel insane.
The Scent of Betrayal, Paul Kelly's. There was something about the warming weather that drove the desperate a little wild. With spring came more boats, and with those boats, more immigrants hoping to carve out their own piece of the rotten fruit that was the city. And as spring teased the promise of summer, tempers began to flare. Always with something to prove, the new crop of boys would try their luck with knives or guns as they worked to claim meager pieces of territory. Street corners, back alleys, nothing worth dying over, but they did just the same. With his cane and uneven gait, it was nearly impossible for Dolph to go unnoticed by those who might not know any better. It would have been easier to use the cover of night to do what needed to be done, but some business required the stark light of day to send a message that he didn't fear anyone in the city, not the Order of Ortus Aurea, whose constant presence kept his kind crawling in the gutters, not the men at Tammany who'd clawed themselves to the top of the city only to forget they'd been born in the slums,
and not Paul Kelly, who seemed to be planning a move to establish himself as a true rival. Kelly fashioned himself a knob, and, if it weren't for that crooked nose of his, evidence of his days as a boxer, he probably could have blended in at the opera. He sure spent enough to dress the part. But at heart, Kelly, whatever his adopted moniker might suggest, was a paisan. The fancy clothes, the well-heeled style, it was all a cover so he could pretend he was different from every other Dago fresh off the boat, crawling through the muck of the city to make something of themselves. When Dolph entered, Kelly's men came to attention, their hands reaching for the guns they kept beneath their coats, but Kelly waved them off.
"Dolph Saunders, quel est votre plaisir?"
he asked, slipping into perfect French. So he doesn't want his boys to hear us, Dolph understood.
Il est temps de rappeler vos hommes.
It's time to call off your men. Kelly's wide mouth turned down.
I'm not sure I can. My boys have been having a good time of it, he said, nodding to John Torrio, who sat at the table across the room.
They went too far setting that fire, Dolph growled. 6 people died in those blazes, 4 of them children.
Kelly gave a careless shrug.
You said you wanted pressure on Darrigan.
On Darrigan, yes, Dolph said. But killing innocents wasn't the deal.
There aren't any innocents in this town,
Kelly told him. He pulled a silver case from his inside jacket pocket and took his time selecting one of the thin, perfectly rolled cigarettes inside. He had style, Dolph admitted, feeling tired and older than his own 26 years. Kelly was only a couple years younger than Dolph, but he had something that felt new. Kelly had a different style, one that drew the boys who filled the barroom around them, one that could be dangerous if it ever found a wider audience. Dolph took the seat across from Kelly without waiting for an invitation.
That may be, but I have Darrigan now. Our deal's done.
Kelly took 2 long drags on the cigarette and let the smoke curl out of his wide nostrils.
You know, I got to thinking.
Why would Dolph Saunders need Hart Darrigan? And why would Hart Darrigan be sniffing around with Jack Grew, especially when Jack's a member of the Order? I thought to myself, those 2 things can't be coincidences. He squinted a little as he took another drag. So I asked myself, what do they know that I don't?
I don't know what you're talking about, Dolph said easily. Hart was mine first, that's all. I wanted him back.
That's a nice story,
Kelly smiled around the cigarette.
But I don't buy it. You're no stranger to taking what isn't yours. Speaking of which, how is my dear sister these days?
Dolph allowed himself a cold smile.
She sends her love. It comes with a blade and a handful of curses I couldn't repeat in mixed company. Might offend the delicate sensibilities of your boys there.
Sounds like Viola.
He gave Dolph a challenging look.
She'll betray you eventually, you know, and return to me. I'm family, and she knows the importance of family. Il sangue non è acqua. I'm not sure she knows the truth of that.
She will,
he said, and the threat was clear.
She's under my protection.
For now,
Kelly said smoothly, and then shifted onto a new topic.
I've been hearing things around town about this big shindig the boys in the Order have planned. This conclave at the end of the year. Word is anyone who's anyone will be there.
Only if you're a member of the Order,
Dolph said. Kelly's expression never changed.
So maybe I'll become a member.
Dolph let out a surprised laugh before he realized Kelly was serious. Kelly leaned forward, his expression determined.
I'm not like you, Saunders. I aim to be someone someday.
You're already someone, Dolph argued. You control half the block south of Houston right now. You didn't need the Order for that.
No, I didn't need them. But it wouldn't hurt to have that kind of power on my side now, would it?
He smiled, a leering sort of grin that had all of Dolph's instincts on alert.
It's a pipe dream, Kelly. The Order only takes their own kind. You might have power, and you might even have enough money, but it will never be the right kind of money to get in with the Blue Bloods uptown.
Kelly took another long drag on the cigarette and eyed Dolph like he was weighing the pros and cons of giving anything away.
Then he stubbed it out in the crystal bowl sitting on the table next to him, twisting the slender butt between his meaty fingers.
Maybe you're right. But like I said, I was curious, so I started asking around. And I started listening, and what I hear is that you're after some book the Order has.
Dolph felt suddenly paralyzed. Someone had talked. Someone he'd trusted had said too much, given too much away. There was a weak link in his organization. Maybe even a rat.
So I said to myself, Dolph Saunders and I, we are smart men, well-read and erudite and all that, but there's no book worth risking the wrath of the mayor's precious little boys' club, unless it's some powerful book.
If those rumors were true, I'd deserve what I got for my stupidity,
Dolph said, leaning back in his chair and making a show of his amusement. Kelly smiled like he could see right through him.
Playing dumb doesn't suit you, Rudolfo.
Dolph remained silent. He didn't let his expression so much as flicker.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So that's how it's to be.
Kelly shrugged as he lit another cigarette.
Fine. This isn't a tea party. You want me to call my boys off Darrigan? I'm gonna need something more from you. Something Darrigan can't give me. You and I both know he can do an awful lot, and this book, from the sound of things, it can do an awful lot, too. Maybe more than even you can.
A deal's a deal, Kelly.
Dolph stood to take his leave.
I already gave you what you needed on the mayor, and Darrigan's playing nice now.
Paul Kelly laughed, the smoke from his cigarette spilling from his nose like he was some sort of demonic beast.
I'm not your dog, Saunders, and I won't be brought to heel. As far as I'm concerned, Darrigan's still mine. You want him outright, it's gonna cost you.
Even as Kelly spoke those words, Dolph was already planning how to deal with this new development. His grip tightened on his cane.
Name your price.
I want the Strega.
Dolph laughed.
I'll see you in hell first.
Your words, not mine,
Kelly said easily.
You're going to regret the day you crossed me,
he said, standing. Paul Kelly gave him a smile that was all teeth.
I doubt that, Saunders. I doubt that very, very much.
Dolph didn't say anything as he turned to go. If he were honest with himself, he would have admitted that he'd sensed betrayal growing thicker in the air for weeks now. The uneasy energy of a lie being told. The heady anticipation that marked the casting of rigged dice. But Dolph hadn't been honest on the day he was born, and he certainly wasn't any better now. Not when he'd lost so much, and not when everything depended on keeping those losses a secret. Temptation comes in many forms. Bollocks Theater. The bottle of night wine was still sitting on Hart's dressing room table. He swore he could hear it calling to him ever since the girl had taken up residence in his small apartment. It was bad enough that she'd blown through his neat, orderly life with her very presence. The off-key singing that carried through the bathroom door as she soaked in his porcelain tub. The silk stockings draped over the parlor furniture. The smell of the floral soap she used that didn't seem to match the hard-nosed stance she took on absolutely everything, but suited her just the same. It had permeated the air in his apartment, and he had the feeling that the scent of it would remain even after she was gone. And she would be gone. As soon as the job was over, she'd leave, just like everyone left. Just like he would leave as soon as he could. Well, good riddance, then. He wanted her gone. He wanted his life back. He wanted a way out of this mess he'd found himself wrapped up in. He picked up the bottle of night wine and rolled the liquid around inside it. Evelyn appeared in his door.
You look horrible, she said.
Thanks. She wasn't wrong. He had deep circles under his eyes from not sleeping. But how was he supposed to sleep on that lumpy couch that barely held him, especially when he knew she was less than 10 feet away? Maybe it really had been too long since he'd been with a girl. That had to be all it was. He eyed Evelyn. She seemed to read his mind.
What?
She said with a sly smile.
Nothing, he told her,